Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!"
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Greasters. Hope you're having an okay week. I know it's pretty dark, isn't it? It's getting hard. I bought some candles. Went mad and bought a load of candles. I don't know if it's going to make me feel better, but I don't know. I'll keep you updated. I'll let you know. This week, I am talking to the incredible Robert Diamond. You may know Robert already if you listen to the Talk Art podcast with Russell Tovey. It's a brilliant podcast. I can't recommend it enough. Even if you think, oh, I don't know anything about art, just listen to it, because that's sort of the premise of starting from a completely egalitarian point of view of just, we just like art, we're going to talk about it. It really is a wonderful, wonderful show. He's a former musician and director of the Carl Friedman Gallery. An extremely interesting person, and I was really, really grateful that he gave up his time during lockdown to speak to me. Robert came in to talk to me about his brother, who died when they were teenagers. Diament.
Diament, yeah.
That's interesting. I want to hear about this.
Yeah, so it's not actually my birth name. My birth name is related. It's like spelt differently. It's D-I-M for mother, E-N-T. And
okay.
I was in a pop band when I was a kid, and I started doing music from a really young age, like 14 or something. And my manager I had in my late teens was like, Diment sounds like demented. So it's not very pop. So we added an A to it, which made it a bit like, they wanted me to be Diamond. And I was just like, no, because that doesn't feel like me. So I made it Diament, which has now stuck, because when you have two albums out and you do it for 15 years, people then know you as that. So I kept it in my art career. And now podcasting
career.
I like it. Yeah. Rob, but actually, I'll get onto that in a bit, because I think part of the reason I wanted to have that distance was to do with the grief and all that stuff.
Oh,
yeah, it was somehow. Yeah, it is interesting. It's quite, and I've only realized that in the last few years.
Yeah, it takes time, doesn't it? It takes time for these things to drop in. Your podcast, we should talk about very briefly, Talk Art, is, I love it. It's so good. It's so good. You've been doing a lot of episodes in quarantine, I've noticed.
Oh my gosh, we've recorded about 40 or something. It's just been like nonstop. I co-host it with Russell Tovey, the actor, and we're best friends. And the podcast was a big accident, actually. It wasn't planned. And I hadn't even listened to any podcast before we did it. It was kind of a bizarre thing that happened. And I was super resistant to it, because I think having done the music for so long, and partly why I stopped was that I hated being on stage. And I really didn't enjoy the promotion or interviews. And I think I hadn't quite worked out who I was, to be honest. Like now in my late 30s, I completely feel confident in who I am, which I think comes through in the podcast. Like I don't care anymore what people think, and I'm just like doing my thing. But the podcast has been such an amazing sort of thing for me to have because it's given me so much self-confidence and I've really enjoyed it. And the biggest thing that we've realized from doing it, which I think is actually very similar to yours, which is actually why I started listening to yours and why I connected to it, was because this idea of therapy, I think it's some kind of like art therapy. And I think we get to sort of chat to people about their whole life. And, you know, yes, we interviewed like Wolfgang Tillmans recently, the really famous photographer. And halfway through, he began talking about his HIV diagnosis. And he's become a complete kind of activist for that. And I was so kind of surprised that we were talking about it. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't even know. So it was a kind of amazing thing. And people are really being generous and opening up. And I feel like yourself, we've kind of created a safe space in a way for people just to chat about what creativity is. And also there's so much connection to grief and trauma. Yeah. And that's a lot of the reason I got into art. So yeah. Yeah, so talk art has changed my life, really.
It's really interesting because, of course, all art is inherently personal. So of course it's wrapped up in... if you have had a grief or a trauma, of course that's in there. And I think sometimes what I think your podcast is good at is we sometimes approach art as like, oh, art with a capital A, you have memories of school and museums and you're like, well, and you remove any personal from it. Yeah. Whereas actually the best thing about going to see any exhibition is reading this bit and being like, oh my God, that happened to them. That happened. That's what that painting is about. I see like context, which we remove all the time and expect people just to look at a picture and like it rather than be like, no, understand what was happening. Understand why that was radical that they did it.
And
like
there's
that.
A huge pressure I think people feel. Like, I remember going to dinner parties and people would sit next to me and the minute I said I was a gallerist or even before that when I was in my band, you got a bit of a kind of like you're in a band, like, and people feel like they can't relate to it, so they just don't want to talk to you. And with art it's even worse though. People are like, sorry, I don't know anything about art, therefore we can't talk to each other. And I would just be like, what are you talking about? Like, everyone has an experience with art, even from like being a young kid when you might make art, or, you know, even if it's just like having postcards in your kitchen, like that can be a collection. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I think that's what we've been trying to explain to people is like, art is actually an inclusive thing. It doesn't have to be this elitist, high-end kind of multi-million pound, you know, big deal thing. It can actually be something way more personal, and you can express yourself through what you look at and what you like. And we've started writing a book now. We've just finished it, actually. We handed in the manuscript last week, and it's coming out next May in 2021. And the first chapters are like our childhoods and like how we got into art and then how we became friends. And Russell and I met through Tracy Emin, the artist. And one of the reasons we both bonded with her work was this idea of trauma and the way that she was kind of using art as a way of kind of working through her own childhood and teens and then adulthood. And this idea of like turning trauma into something positive. We both completely connected to that.
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? It's so interesting what art can do. And when you just, like you said, remove that elitist feel of it and just be like, just look at what's happening, look at the reaction, don't judge it, don't think this is good, this is bad, just what's the reaction. Well, if you haven't listened to the podcast Talk Art, you definitely should. It's very, very interesting, even if you think art's not for you. But obviously, Rob, that's, I could talk to you about art. Sadly, I can't go on your show apart from my terrible drawings. So who are we remembering today?
Today, I wanted to talk about my brother, Andrew. Andrew Diamant, with the different spelling of his
name. Yeah, Andrew Diamant. Okay.
Yeah. So he was my older brother and he died in 1994 when he was 17 and I was 13.
Gosh, that's very young.
Yeah, he was really young. And I was young too. The whole thing was quite... it was deeply shocking, you know, and deeply traumatic. But I don't think I acknowledged that until literally 10, 15 years later. It was like, took me so long.
And it's so common with any kind of teenage child bereavement. It's so, like, we don't acknowledge enough how you cannot get your head around that when you're 13, 14, 15. Like, it takes you another 10 years to be like, oh, what just happened? Like, what was that? Do you mind me asking what happened to him?
Yeah, so he died in a nightclub. I think he actually died in hospital, but he collapsed in a nightclub in Windsor, because I grew up in Berkshire in Maidenhead, which was this incredibly kind of conservative, safe, you know, idyllic place. And I grew up next to a town called Cookham, which is actually where the painter Stanley Spencer is from.
Yeah, I was going to say,
And my mum was part of that, kind of helping promote that little museum. So we had kind of references to art in my childhood and stuff from that, but I never really liked any of it. And then growing up by the river, you know, it was all super idyllic. And my parents had come from quite simple beginnings in a way. Like, my mum grew up in Wales on a farm with seven brothers and sisters. And I think there were seven of them in total. And my dad grew up in Tenby. So my mum was from Newport, I think, and my dad was from Tenby. So they both came from these very like humble beginnings. And then through that whole like Thatcher era, they were the kind of people that like, they were originally, I think my dad worked in animation. He did like Henry's Cat and
oh my God, I loved like, Henry's Cat I think
it
so
was that.
Much.
I think he did something with that, and then it was that whoever the guy was behind that cartoon.
Yes,
I think
yeah, that really distinctive.
Them. And before that, he did like the New Avengers, like the kind of title sequence, and it was the first time they had, you know, like a moving animation in a TV show or something. So he was from a physics side, like a science background, but he kind of left Tenby and they went to Manchester or somewhere and then to London, and they kind of like rose up, and they were those people that kind of like made themselves and kind of, you know, did really well at business. And my mum had a PR company and originally worked in the Natural History Museum. So I came from that kind of thing where you've got this lovely house with a garden and it was all very chill. Life was great. And then suddenly my brother dies.
And is it just died, you and him?
Yeah, it was just brother. Me and yeah. him. Yeah. And he died in a nightclub called Mirage, which was like this kind of, you know, like a dance nightclub in Windsor, you know, where the Queen's Castle is and everything. And that gives you an idea of what the area is like. You know, it's like super kind of quaint and middle class.
Yeah,
and
safe, I think, is a very, I know what you mean by like, yeah, sleepy, safe, suburban.
Exactly, yeah. And you would never imagine anything like that would happen to you.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably why it was so devastating. And my mum and dad had worked so hard to kind of like provide for us and to, and there'd been this whole thing for a long time where my brother would be, for years before he started smoking. And I remember it being this conversation between my parents and him that it was like, you know, smoking leads to cannabis leads to, you know, heroin or something. And it was this constant threat. And then you had the whole kind of house scene that really grew. And my brother became a DJ. And from the age of like 15, he was DJing loads. And he was also really into like Jimi Hendrix. And he had a band. They had the funniest name. They were called Bellington Roots, like after Wellington Boots. I mean, it was so ridiculous. And they got really into like drawing all their own artwork and putting out like cassette tapes and EPs that they would then sell at school, you know.
Yeah.
So I was watching this as like a 10, 11 year old and completely obsessed with it. And I think that's why I then later went into music myself.
Yeah. Cooler than like a big brother, is there? It's just like, what my brother was quite similar, actually, like was a DJ, was into the rave scene. And I remember just thinking like, oh, that's like obviously the coolest thing ever, because I'm 4 years younger, even though that the DJ decks blaring out of his room was like the most loudest sound ever.
Yeah, no, exactly.
I completely can relate to that, looking at somebody bigger, just being like, oh, wow, that's how you live. Like, that's what big people do.
Yeah. And I remember coming home from school, because I was like 3.5 years younger than him, so almost 4 years as well. And I remember coming home and the whole house would be shaking with music. And I initially didn't like the dance, because he'd been into like indie, like The Cure and like the Pixies and like all that stuff, which I kind of got more. I never liked it because I was a pop kid. Like, I grew up listening to like Prince and Madonna and Kylie. And I was I knew I was gay from like a really young age. And I just was very like OTT with my music taste. And things like terrible bands like Shampoo, they were just amazing.
Shampoo,
they
I
were
love
amazing.
Shampoo.
They were like girl power before the Spice Girls. I loved them. Yeah. I knew every word. And actually, I remember my brother coming up one summer. I think it was the summer before he died. And I'd learned the words to Trouble, like, we're in trouble.
We're in trouble.
And I'd been singing it in my bedroom and practicing it. And my brother came up and was like, that's so cool. Like, he actually was really encouraging to me. And he was like, that's amazing. You've learned all the lyrics. So even though it was like a different genre, he kind of appreciated the fact that I also was finding joy and creativity in music.
So he collapsed in the nightclub, and then was taken to us. So where were you at home? How did you find out?
He'd started going out a lot, and he used to have like sort of, when my parents would go away at the weekend, he would invite all his friends around, and he was kind of old enough that maybe they'd go away for a day or something, like during the day, you know, out to play golf or something, as you do, you know, in that kind of society we were living in. And his friends would all come around and they'd sit in the garage and like smoke weed, you know, they'd kind of gone from cigarettes to weed. And I tried to smoke in about 91 at the age of 11, like no joke, like so young, because I was trying to impress my brother. And I just never liked it. And I used to like smoke and then breathe out the smoke instead of inhaling it, or blow into the cigarette. So the cigarette would like still go down. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I remember giving up smoking like really dramatically at the age of 12. I think when I turned 12, I was like, I'm quitting, you know. So I had this very like strong moral voice in me, which I think came from my mum probably, because I could hear her telling my brother a lot to like not smoke. And she really kind of was fighting that and wanted to protect him, I guess. So when yeah, he went out one night, and they used to go out every weekend, and I think he'd been to Amsterdam a few times, and he was just enjoying himself, you know? And
yeah.
And I remember his friends came round that evening, and I was watching TV, you know, like kind of like Bruce Forsyth or something yeah. on a Saturday night, you know, and I used to love all that. And I remember feeling quite sad that he was now going out and that he wasn't going to watch it with me anymore.
Mm.
And his friends came over, they all went out, and he just never came home again. And so the next morning, I think he should have come home maybe, and he hadn't come home. And I remember thinking, like, that's weird, but I just figured he'd stayed at his friend Max's
yeah,
house
yeah.
and whatever. And then I was writing an essay, I always remember this, about To Kill a Mockingbird. And
oh my goodness.
Because I was like 13, so I was in that kind of year where you're prepping for your GCSEs or whatever. So it was starting to become a bit more serious, this idea of homework. And I just could not write it. And I wasn't interested in this book at all, even though later I realized, you know, what a great book it was. But I was sat there trying to write this essay, and then suddenly the doorbell rings, and my mum and my dad answered the door, and it was the police. And I kind of overheard the conversation. And then my mum came up and was like, look, the police are here. Something's happened with Andrew. He's had an accident. We're going to go. Like, you stay here. And then can you call his workplace? So I phoned he was working in a garden centre in Beaconsfield. Mm. And I actually thought about that the other day because I knew I was doing this talk. And I remembered that I used to love going to see him at the garden centre because he used to get access to like the ice cream counter and he used to give me, I think he used to nick them. I mean, it's so,
of course,
so illegal.
But 16-year-old working at a garden centre. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. They were 50p Twister ice creams.
Oh, yeah.
You know, those
yeah.
kind of yellow and green with the strawberry
yes,
inside.
Yes, and you can lick the ice cream right off.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So he used to like steal one basically at the end of every shift and then bring it for me. So
that's
we had this
so
kind
cute.
Of very sweet friendship.
Yeah.
And in our young childhood, like when we were young kids, you know, maybe like 4 to 10 or something, we were much more like odds, and he just thought I was some sort of like ballet dancer eccentric person that constantly wanted to put on performances for my family friends. He kind of liked it, but not really. And
yeah.
then he was this much cooler, like rebellious, you know. So I called a few people up and said, oh, Andrew can't come to work today. I remember leaving a message on their answer phone. And as I said it, I was kind of like, what's actually happened? This is so strange.
Mm.
And then I tried to go back and write my essay, as you would, and I just couldn't do it. And then maybe 2 hours later, my dad came back and he never said like, Andrew's died. He just said, Andrew's not coming home. And he was crying. So I was like, I didn't really know what had happened. So this vicar was with him who'd driven him. So he didn't come in his car either. And I was like, where's my mum? Like, it was so strange. And this vicar was kind of like, almost like apologizing to me or something. And he was very like serious and almost kind of quiet and somber, you know, and I just didn't know what was going on. So my dad was like hugging me and kind of crying and kind of saying, Andrew's not coming home. So I was like, fine. So then we get in the car. I genuinely didn't know what had happened. And
yeah,
we get
so
in the car.
It's confusing when you're that age, isn't it?
Yeah, but he'd obviously come back because they were like, we've left Rob alone, and they must have suddenly felt like they wanted to protect me. You know, I can't imagine what they were going through. But I got in the car and it was this little like Fiat Panda or something, and we drove all the way to High Wycombe, and yeah, and we turned up there and we parked up, and then we walked into the hospital, and there was this kind of green door. We were going through all those swing doors as you do in
yeah.
hospitals, and there was this green door, I always remember it, with kind of like reeded glass or like frosted glass, and through it I could just see the shadows of like 2 or 3 people, including my mum. And my mum was crying like I'd never heard her cry before, and I could see her kind of the shape of her body through the glass. And I just remember being like, oh my God, Andrew must have died. And that was how I found out. Like, it wasn't like anyone said to me, Andrew's
yeah.
died. It was that was kind of how I did it. And then when I walked in the room, my mum just hugged me, everyone broke down, but I didn't, because I just felt like I didn't really understand what was going on, in a way.
I think that's so such a common thing with teenagers, or especially 13, because you really are just on that cusp of not
yeah,
being
and
a,
I was
a
like a month
kid.
From my 14th birthday.
Oh God,
so
yeah, like it's
I was
you're
kind
so
of quite
young.
Already becoming quite independent and angsty
yeah.
and angry anyway.
Of course, yeah, it's totally, I really understand, yeah, because I was 15, nearly about 3 months off from being 16, I think. And
when your dad died.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I think like, because you just don't know what's going on. Like, it sounds so silly, doesn't it? But you're so confused. I remember being so confused. Like, what happened? Like, I knew he had died. We'd see, like, you know, he'd had cancer. And then I remember we went back to the house and friends started appearing and they were crying and hugging me. And I remember just like, sort of like being stiff and being hugged and just being like, yeah. Because it was just like, it doesn't, your brain is really struggling to understand what dead means, what that means, that someone's not coming home. Like, you've had no experience of it. You're like scrabbling for something, aren't you? And you just, you're like, well, I don't. Yeah. And I feel like I spent about 10 years just going, what? Sorry, what? What just happened? Like, I don't understand. Like, even though I knew he's dead, carry out, that's what happened. I just couldn't. It's just, it was so confusing. Such confusing when you're that young.
I think one of the things for us that was so different probably to your experience was that because it happened out of the blue.
Yes, of course, such a shock.
The main thing, I think we spent years telling ourselves, I remember everyone in my family talking about it, was like, what if? Like, what if he hadn't gone to that club? Ugh. Like, what if he'd gone with a different group of friends? Mm. What if he had taken a different tablet? Because he took ecstasy and he even took like half a tablet or one tablet and died from it. So it was kind of like, you know, what if he, it was all like, what if basically. And we lived with that for years. Yeah. And then I suddenly realized it was just really unhelpful because the truth is you can't change it. And it did happen. And that's when you have to kind of accept it. But I remember, but going back to the hospital, we were in that room and then the doctors came through and said like, do you want to say goodbye to Andrew? So I was kind of like, yeah, okay. And my parents, I think, had already seen him. I'm not sure. But they actually took us through to like the kind of morgue room, you know, where they have the tables and stuff. And he was there. And I remember walking through and there was a whiteboard on the wall that like had his name written on it. And it had kind of been like, some of it had been rubbed out, but it still had his name on. And it was so surreal. And then I walked into the room and he was there, like lying down. And obviously he was dead and very pale. And it was just so weird because he looked like so much more fat. Like he kind of looked fatter than he did, if that makes sense. Mm. Like, because I think, I don't know why, but it was very odd. And I think somebody said, do you want to like kiss him goodbye? And I was like, well, no, because I never kissed him in real life. Like, when he was alive, like it just felt super weird. And I don't think for years I really understood maybe how traumatic that is as an experience to sort of suddenly see someone dead.
Oh God, especially when you're just at home, like you said, just at home writing an essay with nothing dramatic happening in your life other than, oh, this essay's hard. Like, and then, oh, your brother's died. Like that is, that switch from sort of, like you said, cosseted, lovely childhood to, oh, real life, this is what can happen. Is that sounds so traumatic, violent almost.
And I think there was a big part that my mum and I and my dad felt that like we should have done more. Because the trouble is, like, my mum, every time there'd been a newspaper, she used to read the Daily Mail because she's a kind of, you know,
shout out to my mum too.
I don't think she reads it anymore, actually. I think she went off it. But there was a period of time where my mum was hilariously like anti Channel 4 and kind of like read the Daily Mail. And there I was as her young gay son, you know, loving Derek Jarman or something. But yeah, I remember feeling that kind of sense of guilt that like, I think I had taken on my mum's anxiety and was trying to tell my brother like, but you know, you've got to protect yourself because accidents happen. And my brother had this very kind of like filmic kind of hero, almost like James Dean or something, this kind of like, you know, I'm going to live forever. I'm really cool. Like, creativity, make music. And he just was so relaxed about it. And I know now there's nothing we could have done. I mean, accidents do happen. In a way, it was an accident. Yeah. And I remember years later, maybe like 10 years ago, I went for a dinner and I used to do this weird thing. At every dinner I went to, one of the conversation topics would be like, oh, so, you know, where did you grow up? And I'd be like, well, my brother died. And I would always bring it up as like a dinner conversation. And then people would be like totally shocked. And I think it was because I hadn't done enough therapy yet. And I was trying to like talk about it with strangers as a way of me processing it. And it's the weirdest thing.
Course,
I don't do it
course.
Anymore at all, really. But it honestly was like my biggest kind of dinner conversation was to talk about my brother's death. It was so weird.
I don't think it's weird. I think it comes from being a child when something happens and not having like that bit of your brain that processes. I mean, you know, when I interview adults who have struggled with sudden death, with sibling loss, with parental loss. And then you think, you can see them going, oh my God. And they were, you know, 25, 30, and they've struggled. Like, you're 13. Like, sometimes we go, oh, I was a teenager. I used to do this all the time. Go, oh, yeah, I was 15. Like, that's pretty grown up. Because you feel quite grown up at that time.
Yeah.
And it took me again, like 10, 15 years to look back on that 15-year-old and go, oh, I was really young.
Yeah.
Why was I expecting so much of myself? Why was I expecting myself to be like, not weird about it, not bring it up, not suddenly cry and run off in parties for no reason? Like, all these things you would like, I would berate myself for, or like, oh, you're not handling it like a normal person. You're like, yeah. What the fuck? There is no normal to handle it. Like, you're just a kid.
No, and I think that idea of minimizing it and kind of shrugging it off because it's just something that happened in when you were younger and it's not really that big a deal. That was definitely something I did too. The problem that happened after, which was really unexpected, was because he died from ecstasy. At the time, it was pre-internet. I mean, it's not like I actually Googled him yesterday to see what comes up, and like hardly anything comes up because literally 94 was pre-internet. And it's really interesting to think if you died 10 years later, how you'd be all over the internet forever. Yeah. You know? And there's only like one thing about it from a published newspaper at the time. But at the time, he was on the cover of like most newspapers, and overnight, he was everywhere, and you know, local newspapers, national newspapers, and dying from ecstasy was this very kind of high profile discussion in the media, and they were really running with it. The Sun, the Daily Mail, like all these
was
newspapers.
Was this before, did he die before or after Leah Betts?
He died, I can't remember exactly, but he died, I would say in my head, like 2-3 months before Leah. And
oh,
they
wow.
were trying to get us to, our family, to participate in the way that Leah's did.
Yeah.
And they asked for photographs of him, which we denied, and they asked for interviews and all this kind of stuff. And we came home and there was literally like 30 newspapers camped outside our house, and they stayed for at least a week, I think. So they were constantly trying. And we were like a totally middle class, normal family that had never done anything like that. My mum worked in PR, so she kind of understood it, you know, but not that kind of PR. Do you know what I mean?
That's,
like, she wasn't dealing with the tabloid, she was promoting the National History Museum or you know, like books and kind of cultural things, but not that kind of thing.
Yeah, because I'm, you know, we're of a similar generation, and I remember when the Leah Betts thing happened, I think I was still at primary school, but it was such a big thing, and that for me ingrained in my mind, and I'm a bit like you, the slightly performer conservative, very anxious, it ingrained in my mind, drugs will kill you, like that is what will happen, because they plastered that. That's obviously, poor girl, it was awful, but it was an, if you are young enough not to remember, it was on every front cover, it was discussed on Blue Peter, on Newsround, like that we had a policeman come into the school to talk to us about it. Like, it was such a thing of like, it was huge. So of course, that's really, I didn't realize, obviously, that obviously the tabloids were looking for the story to hook it
and
all on.
It's really interesting to think about as well, because it's kind of before that whole celebrity culture thing happened. Mm. I mean, I know they did write about Diana and there were things like that at the time. But I remember going home and turning on the TV and he was on the local news that we used to watch together. And I was sat in the same chair that I used to sit with him. And that was a long thing for me as well, in sort of there was a good thing about staying in the house. There was this whole discussion at one point about us moving house.
Mm.
And some people were saying like you shouldn't do it, some people were saying you should do it, and we ended up just staying in the house. And for me, I think that really helped to grieve, even though I say, you know, I didn't grieve it till 10 years later or something. I think it does help to stay in the house, to have your routines without that person there anymore. But it's one of the most painful things to experience when you come home from school and he's no longer sat in the chair he used to be sat in, and I'd be watching Newsround on my own, you know. And I remember seeing him on TV though and just being like, this is so surreal. And then the newspapers, and then what happened because of Leah Betts, it just heightened that interest even more. So every time someone died, we would hear a phone ring, and the phone would just ring and ring and ring and ring, to the point where I stopped answering the house phone. And my mum, I think we even used to unplug the phones in the house, like whenever, every time someone died. And the worst story was, which I only remembered the other day actually, was I think about 5 days after my brother had died, my mum and dad had gone out to see the vicar, because they went to a local church in Cookham, which is also where I learned to sing, and you know, it was part of our childhood. Yeah, so they'd gone off, I think, just to talk to the vicar about, maybe it was even about the funeral, I can't even remember. And my grandparents were there, and the doorbell rang, and I was upstairs in my room, which became a kind of haven for me. And I heard this voice, and they were saying they knew my mum and dad, and I was like, I don't recognise that voice. And they came in the house with my grandma waiting for my parents. And I walked down the stairs, and they were sort of walking through to the kitchen. And I was like, hi, who are you? And he was like, oh, hi, I'm from the Today newspaper. Have you got a quote for me about your brother's death? How are you feeling? You know,
God.
When's the funeral? Here's my card. And my grandparents were so shocked. And they were like, get out of our house. And they like kicked him out of the house. And, you know, it's that kind of stuff that happens that's so awful. Because that never leaves you. And it's that sense of, can you imagine, like, my parents must have felt so protective over me after that. And that's what I was mentioning in the beginning of the podcast about changing my surname. I remember my mum particularly being very like, you shouldn't talk about this that much, you know, like in public or anything like that. And I think for years, it took me a long, long time to ever really be myself in public. So I think the whole of, I started writing songs the day after my brother died. Because he'd been in a band and I'd played classical piano for a long time. And the day after he died, I'd started listening to Tori Amos and I wrote this song called All the Boys Hate Him, because at school I was being heavily bullied for being gay, even at that age, like 13. And I felt very like I didn't have many friends. And I wrote this song just by hitting the keys in a kind of formation. So it was almost about how the keys looked, not how they sounded. So it was, I didn't know what chords were at that point.
Yeah.
And I managed to write this whole song kind of based on Tori Amos's song, All the Girls Hate Her, which was a B-side. And then every day until I was probably 20, I wrote a song. So it became this therapy for
wow.
me.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd. Obviously, people can't see it. I was like grabbing myself when you described what that journalist did. I was like holding my collar because I feel like that is so awful. And I'm so glad you are talking about it, because we do talk, not on this show, but, you know, there's a talk in this country of like, oh, the press. And yes, we know we have terrible press. And obviously, I know things have changed since then. But I think anybody who's in the club, who's a griever, can understand how violating that must have been, especially at 13, to have someone speak to you like that and to know at 13, oh, I'm not safe. I have to protect my family now because of the way my brother died. Like, that is, oh, and your poor grandparent, that just must have been so, so traumatic. And I just really, really feel for you, because I, you know, I grew up in a similar, sounds like similar edge of London. On the, you know, you can get a train into London, but we're not really London. And that society is already, like you said, afraid of drugs, judgmental of kids who take them, not understanding, you know, that some people just are just having fun and living their life. And then, like you said, this accident that just happened, to be twisted into sensationalizing it. I just want to say it's disgusting. Like, it's disgusting that happened to
you. And actually, I've just remembered, I think we ended up doing an article ourselves in the Today newspaper, like maybe 3 weeks
after he died. Just to kind of deal with it.
Because they just wouldn't go away.
Yeah.
And I remember the images they were using of my brother weren't from us. So they didn't look like him. I think he had like short hair in a lot of the pictures, whereas when he died, he had really long hair and he had that kind of like rock star kind of look about him. And I think they just got like an old school photo from when he was like 14. So even that, it felt, I remember feeling quite violated by that, like this idea that like the picture of him on the news, the picture of him on the front cover of the newspaper, and I'm sure he was in the Daily Mail, and I remember it coming, getting delivered, and it was very surreal because it was like, that's the paper my mum reads, and it was all super, you know, it's just a very surreal, odd time. And then I remember, because my brother had written so much music, and I think on his Tombstone, whatever, I think we actually put a phrase from one of his songs, which was like, keep smiling through. And I think I then wrote a poem based on that, which we published in that newspaper with a proper picture of him and something. And then we spoke a bit about it. But the way we did it was actually quite creative. And I remember feeling very happy about that at that time, because I felt like it actually represented him, and it represented something more soulful and more kind of human than the way they were just trying to make money out of the
story. And also it sounds like more in your control and more truthful to him. Because at that time, I remember, like, I was saying the other day to my friend, like, that time, like, it was so, the teenagers were so in the news. It was like, girls will get pregnant, that's the worst thing that could happen, and boys or girls will take drugs, and that's also, like, it was such a thing that they, teenagers were these dangerous, awful creatures, and especially that Daily Mail mentality. No wonder, for me, like, no wonder you were in shock for so long. No wonder you're bringing it up at dinner parties, because your poor little brain is probably still going, what?
Like, and actually, I don't think I realised for a long time how rejected I felt by his death. So when he died, I think I took it as this massive rejection somehow, like I'd done something wrong, like I hadn't helped him, and that somehow I'd been like a bad brother or something. I've had a number of different kind of therapies in my life, in my adult life, that have really helped me come to terms with it. But I think in my teens, the way that I coped with it wasn't therapy, because I remember my mum saying to me, like, and my dad, like, and the vicar as well, trying to talk to me about it. And I think I did have one session maybe with the vicar, and I liked him, so I didn't really mind it. But I just didn't want to talk about it. And I kept saying to my mum, you know, I'm writing songs. And it was almost like writing songs was a way to connect to him, because he'd been a musician and I kind of always wanted to be. And prior to that, I mean, I had actually written songs based on like Prince tracks. So I think at the age of like 10, I wrote a song called Love Machine. Do you know what I mean? It was like really wrong on every level. I didn't even know what it meant. But I would write all these like poppy, I don't know, very romantic kind of songs. And the other person that really inspired me through my teenage years was Madonna, funnily enough, which was quite strange, because from the age of like maybe 5, I was obsessed with her, and I loved True Blue, and it was the first album I ever bought. And then because of that story of her mother dying, she used to talk about it quite openly, and it would be in like Smash Hits or all those kind of magazines we'd read when we were kids. And I always remember seeing it as this kind of like fairy tale. It almost wasn't real, the idea that she'd lost her mother like in a fairy tale book or something, and that and then she'd gone to New York and only had $30 and then become this superstar. So I always had that as some kind of template in my head. And then when she did Blonde Ambition and she did that Truth or Dare documentary, I was watching that, and I managed to watch it when I was really, really young, because I think it came out in like 91, 92, and I was probably 11, 12. So it's before my brother had died. And it was the first time I'd seen kind of gay men, you know, represented in such a joyful, fun, quite childlike way, actually, because even though they were in their 20s, these people, and Madonna was maybe even 30 by then, they were all acting like kids, kind of like my age group, you know what I mean? Like, I love her and I think she's great, but she was quite immature in a way. And I think she was a bit of a diva, and it was all this big performance. And I really connected to that. And I think that idea of representation and seeing yourself, you know, it's being talked a lot about now within art because of the whole kind of movements that have happened. You know, if you think about Black Lives Matter and the importance of kind of figuration and the gaps in art history, I think that representation of kind of queer identity, but also this idea of you can survive and you can have lost your mother at the age of 5 and still become a successful person in the world was such a kind of thing that I carried with me.
But do you say you were like angry as a teenager? Like, I was so angry as a teenager, and I was kind of angry beforehand, but for me, like you said, the death, I definitely understand that I did take it somehow as a rejection, and it took me a long time to accept he just died. He didn't do it to sort of piss me off.
Yes.
Like, something in it felt very, very, very personal.
Yeah.
And I think when you're a teenager, you translate that as, oh, I guess I did something wrong. Because people go away when you do things wrong. Like, when you're a dick, they don't want to talk to you. Do you think the anger was coming just from deeply buried grief?
I remember the day after he died, I sat in a bath, because I think I used to find that kind of like a healing experience or something, I don't know, like on a kind of sensory level. And I remember sitting in the bath and being like, oh my God, I'm gay, and my brother's died and he was straight. My parents aren't going to have kids anymore. Like, you know, like grandkids, sorry.
Yeah.
And I felt this huge pressure for years afterwards about that. So that was a big part of it too. And I think I felt kind of like, why have you done this about my brother? So it was kind of like, I think I always felt like I could have been myself, because my brother would have fulfilled those things that you need to do in a family, which I do know later was ridiculous because your parents love you for whoever you are. But when I was, you know, I was born in 1980, so I grew up in the 80s when the AIDS crisis was happening. And I remember like leaflets coming through our door with that kind of like tombstone.
Yes. Oh my God. I remember watching the advert. Kind of
Yeah. The adverts on TV. Yeah. And this idea of it all being super threatening. And so I already had that inbuilt. But also there was no concept of gay people adopting or having children or even being that mainstream or accepted in the way that it's gone on to happen. You know, there was no talk of surrogacy. So in my head, I just assumed I was never allowed to have children and it would never happen. So I just felt this huge guilt that I carried with me for a good 10 years. And I kind of was annoyed at my brother for it.
Yeah.
I just felt like, you know,
Of course. And also you're annoyed in a way that only a little brother can be.
Do you know
what I mean? Like that dynamic of like, like, because that's what you've spent. Like you said, when you have an older brother, like you spend most of the time being like furious at each other. You know, you're trying to like discover who you are at the same time as this person is. So I completely understand that. And I, you know, there wasn't any representation of gay people living like a normal, happy life in a sense, like you said, with a family or children at all. It was like, of course you felt that guilt.
But there was definitely this drive I had. And I remember going to the library at school one day and found this book by Hayden Herrera about Frida Kahlo's life. And I started reading that. And I remember thinking like, you can survive through trauma. And also Tori Amos's story of her rape and how she could sort of turn it around and setting up the Rape and Incest National Network in America. And I found her story incredibly, you know, it was kind of like the sense of solidarity or something.
Yeah.
And it really pulled me through. And David Hockney as well, I think I saw that you could exist in the world as a gay person and it's okay, you know.
I think that's really interesting though, that you had the foresight to find those figures.
Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting that you sort of saw people who'd been through trauma and were like, oh, they survived. Like I loved Tori Amos, but more it was like, oh, well, she's in pain, I'm in pain. Like that was as far as I got.
Right.
Or like Fiona Apple, I went for a big
Me too,
Apple.
I was obsessed with her.
Because it was so like, inspiring. She's in so, and I remember playing one of her albums once and my friend was in the room and my friend stopped and was like, sorry, do you listen to this all the time? And I was like, what? Yeah, and she went, how are you listening to this? Like, this is the saddest thing I've ever heard. And I was like, oh, because I thought, but this is how I feel. Yeah. And I was like, do you not? She was like, I can't, this is so depressing. And I was like, wow, that's what's in my fucking head. Yeah, and to me, Fiona made it normal because I was like, oh, great, yeah, she hates herself. I hate myself. Great, yeah, that's normal. It took my friend saying it to make me go, maybe I'm not all right. Not in a bad way, just in a, oh, I probably do need some therapy.
And actually, those artists, like Fiona Apple's a really great example as well. They were artists that I kind of, they were like a template in a way, you know, for me to do what I did with my music. And the first album I made was called The Invisible Line. And actually, it's the opposite to what we were saying about my brother. Like, my history is all over the internet and you can see my hideous long hair and like all my bad music videos. But my first album was called The Invisible Line. And it was very much, I had this almost like a mission that I wanted to connect to people in tiny towns all over America and all over like Asia and all over the world. And that they would know they weren't alone. And that was really my driving force. So it was almost like some kind of like pressure I'd put on myself. So I was touring America for a good like year or two, and we used to go for like big batches of time where you'd go for like, you know, ten weeks or whatever and then come back for a few weeks and then go back. And I remember just it slowly was growing, like the interest in the band. And I did a duet with a singer called Imogen Heap, and I did some tracks with Guy Sigsworth, who'd actually produced Madonna, and they were like really taking off in the States. So we were getting these tours, and I toured with Darren Hayes from Savage Garden, and I remember being on these tours, and these young kind of teenage girls and guys were like started to follow us from every town. And they would come from like New York to San Francisco to LA, and they'd do the whole of the East Coast or the West Coast and travel with us. And I remember thinking like, this is what I wanted. I wanted to connect to these people. So I really took it on. So I never did any drugs. I never drank. I did nothing. I behaved myself. Like I was in a monogamous relationship for 7 years. And I was on these tours. And after every gig, I would go and talk to all of these fans and spend ages taking on their stuff because I felt like I wanted to help everybody. And it became some kind of thing that wasn't just like a normal pop band for me. It was like, it was so bizarre.
Like a religion. Like it's like,
kind of,
you know,
yeah. It was just really weird. And I eventually started doing therapy and then realized that I think all the music was just me trying to deal with my brother's grief.
Yeah.
And once I dealt with it, I didn't want to write music anymore. It was really strange. I just felt like that chapter in my life had come to an end. And I'd got more and more obsessed with art and wanted to help facilitate artists and support artists. So that's what I did.
I completely understand that. Like when I started the podcast, you know, nearly 4 years ago, like all I wanted to do was to find that 15-year-old in a suburb and make her feel that she wasn't alone. Like, that's all I cared about. I was exactly. like, if that 15-year-old it will Google grief podcast and will find this, then she will listen and she will be like, oh, what's happened to me isn't, I'm not weird, I'm not unique, this is what happens, this is life. And I completely understand that, like, fire in your heart to, like, I have to help them because someone didn't help me. Like, exactly. it wasn't there.
And I'm sure I was offered help, but I always turned it away.
Same, you know? Yeah.
And I think you do also just have to find it at the time that's right for you as well. It's interesting as well, you know, you think of that whole 80s generation of parents. I think there was this whole thing of, like, coming from post-World War, like, from World War II, you didn't talk about things. You kind of had a stiff upper lip. You kind of, you didn't talk about private issues. Whereas I feel like our generation, we are talking about things. And that's actually why podcasts are so liberating, because you can talk about really heavy issues and actually reach so many people because they're free to download. Yeah. So in a way, I remember when this took off, my boss, Carl Friedman, who I work with, he hates me calling him the boss because we're kind of like, we work very closely together.
Yeah,
we both have a very big input in the gallery and what we do. But he said to me, I think the reason this is going so well for you is that you've always, this has been your whole thing, like for the whole of your life, is the idea of connecting to other people and their pain and their trauma and somehow, you know, healing through that or something.
Yeah, and I think it doesn't, like you said, I think it's really interesting that it was music, now it's art. Like, what you're discovering is like, it doesn't matter what the medium is, what's important, somebody wanky, is the message. Yes. And what you're trying to do is connect with people. And I completely understand that. Like, I used to do a lot more comedy than I do now, because I found, a bit like you said with the music, like, it was a way of processing the trauma, but not getting too near. It felt really safe. It was like, I can write about it, I can make jokes, and everyone's laughing, and no one can see how sad I am. And then as I had therapy, I was like, oh, I think I can be okay with the sadness. And actually, I barely gig anymore at all. I do improv, but that's like my fun thing. But I don't do my characters anymore, because I got to this point where it felt like old clothes, you know, like, this doesn't fit anymore.
I can't put this.
Yeah, yeah, I was like, tried to put this jacket on. I was like, what? Who wore this? And you're like, you did. And you're like, no. Oh, I've just changed. And it's like another little grief, isn't it? You're like, oh, okay. I that was really helpful. I really enjoyed it. It really helped. But I do have to let that go and find something else.
You know, this whole thing of, like, not talking about, like, I think I kind of got that from my parents or grandparents' generation, maybe. And, like, I'm just someone that loves to talk. But the therapy that helped me most was where I didn't talk. So
really?
I had another trauma, and I went to do EMDR, which is this thing where you kind of hold, like, buzzing rocks or something.
Yeah.
And it seemed so ridiculous. And the thing I found strangest was he wouldn't let me talk about what the traumas were. So I did this one for the first trauma, and it really healed me. And I'd been on a flight from London to Miami for work, and I watched a film called We Need to Talk About Kevin. With Tilda Swinton. And I broke down watching this film, and I couldn't stop crying. So for the whole, like, 7 hours of the flight, or 10 hours, whatever the flight was, I was just in crying so much, they had to move me into first class so that I would have my own space. And this is something people don't talk about. Do you know what I mean?
This
is years later. And I was grieving so much. So I finally dealt with two of these traumas. One was my brother's death, and we did my brother's death second. And they say to you, like, on a scale of 1 to 10, how traumatized are you feeling, or how upset are you feeling? And I'd gone from, like, 13, you know, like, way over 10, down to, like, 2 on both of my brother's death and the other trauma. And it really helped me, though. And after that day, I was, like, a different person. You know, I'd actually got to the point where you couldn't hug me, and I'm still a bit like that now. Like, I didn't want any physical intimacy from strangers. You know, I didn't want to be kissed on the cheek. I really hated it all. I'd become quite kind of, like, just wanted to protect myself the whole time. And I remember Carl, like, tapping me on the shoulder after I'd done the therapy, and he was like, "Oh my God, I think you're you again. Like, you're no longer, like, trying to, like, you know,
flinch,
fight me back." Yeah. And it was really powerful, though. And it's interesting that you can have these types of therapies that are, like, so powerful without talking.
And, yeah, that's really, especially if you are a talker. Like, because I'm the same. I'm such a talker. So, but then I think, I'm currently in talking therapy, but I definitely get into the point where I'm like, oh, I can talk myself out of anything, can't I? So I might have to start listening. Yeah, thanks. That's what we go to therapy for.
And there is also a thing, though, of talking therapy where they say that you can re-traumatize yourself.
Especially
that's true. With kind of, like, sexual violence and things like that. I think it can be bad to actually relive the experience. But so for years after, maybe 2 years after I did, because I think I did it in, like, 2011. So maybe for 2 years after EMDR, I felt like I wasn't allowed to talk. And I'd got to the point where suddenly I was so physically like okay with myself. I'd kind of physically let the grief kind of leave my body. Yeah. And then I felt like I wanted to talk, and it was really conflicting because I kept thinking like, but I'm not supposed to talk because it's going to re-traumatize me. And then eventually I did talking therapy, and it's just been incredible. And I think that's why we do talk art, because I don't think I would have ever done talk art if I hadn't done therapy, because it is a bit like a therapy session.
Yeah. And also I think I found like the more that I've had therapy, the more I'm able to talk about other things. Because like you said, it's not the first thing that's in your head. It's not this like boulder, especially I think if you have a bereavement or suffer a trauma as a teenager, as a young child, you're just carrying it around with you. It's this like thing that happened to you that you're trying to deny all the time. It doesn't matter. It's not a big deal. I'm fine. Even though this rock is so fucking heavy.
Yeah.
And I found as I talked about it and it got easier and I, you know, like, I really understood, like let grief come out of my body, cried, just admitted I was sad. And then I was like, oh, I can actually have a conversation about something else, because it's not like just like you're wearing grief goggles. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And that's what I think sometimes people, that phrase like, oh, time's a healer, is confusing, because you're like, well, I just have to fucking wait. And you're like, no, you need that perspective.
Oh,
yeah, it's horrible. It's awful.
It was so annoying.
But now 20 plus years in, I'm like, oh, I can see that. I can now see more what I'm doing, what worked, what didn't work, what I need to do when I'm having bad days, when I'm okay. Like, that's actually where that like the root of that phrase, but it's such a useless phrase when it's happened to you.
You just said something that really reminded me of another thing that happened. I remember when I was 17 and I was the same age that he was.
Oh, God, yeah.
And when I turned 17, it really hurt me. And there was this idea that time was a healer and that by 17, I thought I should have healed. And I remember it really hitting me bad. And like, I have this thing that then happened when I outgrew his age. So when I became 18, 19, and I became older than him, for years, it was a strange phenomenon. I remember it really traumatizing me as well. Like, it was this extra layer of kind of this odd thing that somehow I felt guilty that I'd outgrown him and he was no longer my older brother. And like, it was a very odd thing. Yeah.
I think that's so common. And also, like, don't you just wish you could say to that child, like, I remember being like that, oh, well, by 20, I should be over this. Like, come on, 5 years. And you're like, of course you're not over it by 17. Like, of course, like, why? You'll never be, you know, over it. This idea, you carry it, you get better at it, you understand it. But I think that age thing, I had another guest talk about that who'd lost a sister. And yeah, I can, of course, once you start overtaking them, we've got it slightly differently that like none of, like me and my brother are not my dad's age yet, but we're heading towards it. And I know that's going to be weird, like difficult,
that's interesting
painful.
Too, because you've had kids now, haven't you?
Yeah.
Have you got two kids?
I've got two. Yeah, I had one just before lockdown.
Oh, wow. Congrats.
Yeah, thanks.
But I think I heard that, because I think grief, your response to grief can change over time. So if you move to a new house, if you have a new relationship, if you make a new friend, you know, all kinds of things can actually change your perspective and the way you look back on grief. And I've also realized that like a lot of my cousins have died over the years, and like I've had this a lot of trauma in my life, strangely. And even a friend about 10 years or 11 years after my brother died, he killed himself. So there was all these kind of deaths that kept happening. And what I've begun to realize is that grief shifts and changes with every person that dies, and it's never the same experience. And it's a really weird realization, because I think I always thought it was going to be the same. So every time someone died, I was like, right, I know how to deal with this. But you never do, because actually time and your experiences, and I guess, you know, if you get married, suddenly that dynamic would, not that I have, because I'm single now, but but when you do get married or you're going out with somebody, I think you then have a dynamic that maybe reminds you of your parents' dynamic, or and there's all these kind of layers. So with grief, it's like so complicated, and it's so within all those emotions, you know, it's a deep rooted thing.
Yeah, oh, definitely. And I think I've got better at letting that change. I think for a long time I've fought it. I was like, no, I'm just getting married. Nothing's changed. It's no big deal. It doesn't matter. He's still dead. So what? And now I'm like, yeah, you know, you've had a baby, you've moved out, like, or something does well in your career, or you're like, oh, and now I just kind of let the sadness come up and be like, oh, I wish he was here to see this. He's not. Okay, there it is for a bit. And because I don't fight it, it just comes and goes, and I,
and
it's,
you know,
so
what?
Much
That's
easier.
Such good advice is like, just roll with it and don't try and control it, because it's okay. You're going to feel something. It's actually a natural thing to feel that grief. It's a helpful, natural process in a way that your body and your mind is creating to protect you. And I think what I did, I remember walking down the street the week after my brother died, actually to go and buy Madonna's single Secret or something had just come out. And I remember thinking, like, everyone on the street is just going with their daily business. Mm. And my brother's just died, and I was so furious about it. And I almost felt like I was putting on this armor to go into battle. And I held that armor on until I was 27 or something. Do you know what I mean? I carried
it
with me.
Yes, I do.
And that strength and that... And that thing and the kind of focus I put on my music career is kind of why it did take off to a level, you know, to a point where I was touring, where I got my records out all over the world and all that stuff, was because I was so focused. And so it was all from anger, though. It was all from this kind of trying to be the strongest person I could ever be. Mm. But actually, I think it's healthy not to do that too much. You need it to survive.
Yeah.
And I've experienced it with other trauma where, like, the day after, you just act like nothing's happened and you can just walk outside and go on for a year. And then I'll break down, you know, a year later, whether it be a breakup, you know, whatever it is. And I have to tell myself now, when I have emotional situations, not necessarily grief, but in any, or even a challenging business situation, to just allow yourself to feel it in that moment and not to be this strong superhero that's wearing a suit of armor and is going out for the next 2 years, because it's actually really harmful to you.
Yeah, I mean, that's literally what my entire therapy sessions have been about. It's like, and I think, I wonder, I don't know, if that does happen when you lose someone very young, is that because you're confused, because you don't understand, like you said, I completely relate. You put on this armor and you feel like, okay, I can deal with the world, because no one is getting through. No one is getting through to this. That I am, like, you think you know me. No one knows me. I'm fine. Like, these hundreds of walls you build up, and you think you've done a good thing. Like, I thought, oh, that's good. I figured it out. That's what you have to do with grief. You have to really protect yourself and don't ever, like, you know, don't ever get too close or engage or, you know, ever let go of anything, because you have to be in control. And realizing, like, no, actually, like you said, that's unhelpful. But that, again, takes perspective, takes time, takes maturity. So I think, like, I always say to people, like, whatever place you are on the journey, don't berate yourself. Like, it just will come and go and get easier and better.
Someone said to me that the best thing you can do is, like, sort of look after yourself so that your mum won't worry, or your you know, work colleagues won't worry about you anymore. And I think that's also quite important. And it doesn't, I don't want it to be like a pressure, because it sounds like I'm being quite strict about it. But I think in quite a kind of healing way, it's just good to take care of yourself. And try and have fun as well and enjoy yourself, because I think I've spent way too many years taking everything so seriously.
Yeah, same.
But I've learned, like, since my friendship with Russell, actually, Russell Tovey, like, he's made me laugh. You know, like, for the first time, I never really had friends that made me laugh, like, in my belly. And I think that's why we've only ever had one argument, and it was last week in the whole time, because I was so exhausted from everything. We had a little bizarre argument over nothing. But, like, he's the one person in my life that made me laugh. And I'm really holding on to that now, because we're only here for a short time, and you may as well enjoy yourself. And even if you're single, like I am, that doesn't matter either, because your friendships are just as important, you know. And I think I'm feeling super lucky at the moment and grateful. And I don't know, it's like a bit cheesy.
No, it's good.
I think it is something to remember.
Yeah, and I think it's a really good place to end. What a nice message to end on.
Yeah,
and exactly. Thank you so much for talking to us about Andrew.
You're so
really
welcome. Thank you for inviting
really
me.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You can follow Robert on Twitter and Instagram at Robert Diament, that's Diament. And the official talk art book, which he's written with Russell Tovey, is available for pre-order now. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. Music was provided by The Glue Ensemble. Show is edited by Kate Holland. Artwork by Jade Perkin. And remember, you're not alone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.